You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
At least you could manage to be on time. After your mother goes to all the trouble to prepare a fine meal, it's only common courtesy, Chuck.
Welcome to episode 215 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by author Toby Rohn to discuss a 1977 film that is one of the most overlooked films from an A-list star/director, starring Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke, directed by Clint Eastwood. It's The Gauntlet. But first,
who are the people who are most likely to succeed? What's the secret of their success? Let's see if
the Forgotten Filmcast
can help us find the answer.
Good evening, folks, and a hearty welcome to our drive-in theater. We have a wonderful evening's entertainment lined up for you, one that will provide several hours of pleasurable relaxation and diversion for you and your family. Did you fail to dress up for tonight's show? No tie, an old shirt and slacks, a house dress? Well, don't give it a thought. We're glad you came as you are. We just want you to enjoy yourselves. Don't forget to visit our refreshment center during the intermission or any time. You love the tasty array of snacks we have to offer. So will the youngsters. Everything is quality and so good. We hope you'll make this a weekly visit. Bring the family. Bring your friends. There are always wonderful new pictures to see, delightful snacks to nibble, a gay, pleasant evening for all. Oh, a word of caution. Don't drive over 10 miles an hour in the theater area for your safety's sake. And Mom or Pop, go with the kids when they leave the car. We hope you have a wonderful time. Come back soon.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Started off as an innocent prank.
that erupted in savage violence.
I'm gonna kill him! I'm gonna kill him!
Look at that, Jake, huh? You think she had fun when she filled her car with garbage, huh?
Shut up, Red.
That doesn't do, Brenda. What are you gonna do about it?
All right, girls.
Sorry about your sister, Brenda. The police are doing everything they can. But she shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Charlene, I love her so much. What am I going to do if Heather dies?
We'll meet you guys at the top.
You sure you're not going to hurt her, right, Jake?
Isn't that what I said?
Brenda, you can't take the whole world on by yourself.
You don't know anything.
Justice for one, justice for all. You get what you give when you've broken the law.
For God's sake, it wasn't my fault.
Hey,
what is it?
Wait a minute, man, I don't like it. Something's weird.
What's the matter, boy? Loosener? What a shame.
We're gonna play a little game, baby. Hey, Red! Red!
Oh, yeah.
She came loaded for bear.
No! No!
Oh, my. I missed. And I did so want to see you bleed to death.
You pay for your crime. The judgment will stand. My back's to the wall. It's out of my head.
Good for you, Brenda.
Brenda, baby.
Linda Blair in Savage Streets, where the only law is an eye for an eye.
And now, on with the show.
Where you been? You look awful.
Oh, I had a late night poker.
You should have at least shaved. This new police commissioner, this Blakelock, he's supposed to be very spit and polish. Yeah, but Jesus, God, Ben, you gotta watch the way you look. You can't just walk in one of these big wigs without shaving, you know. You just can't do that, Ben. You should have put on a tie. You should have shined your shoes. You should have made some kind of an effort to spruce up a little bit. You
Mr. Midasfield.
Shotgun, how are you today?
Fine, sir. How's our assistant DA these days?
He couldn't convict Hitler. Don't use any profanity. And remember to say sir to him. If he speaks to you, say sir. Then stand up straight. And for God's sakes, Ben, don't breathe on him. Here, wait a minute, guy. Come on, wait a minute. Here, open your mouth. Open your mouth. I just wish I had time to shave you.
DA Blakelock.
Ben Shockley, sir.
Yeah, I've heard about you, Shockley.
Oh.
As commissioner of the police department, considerable responsibility. Watchdog of the department, so to speak, policing the police. So that the need for absolute secrecy is...
I understand.
Plane tickets. Extradite. Subpoena. You're flying to Las Vegas, coming back with a prisoner for us, whom you will remand to custody of county. And then you report. You know, back to here.
Respectfully, sir, I work for Metro Squad. Why me?
Your division commander says you're a man who gets the job done.
Is there anything special I should know about this case?
What it is this. It's a nothing witness or a nothing trial. That'll be all. Now, Shockley, you represent the Phoenix PD. Get a shave.
Yes, sir.
Okay, our movie this time is The Gauntlet from 1977. And joining me to discuss this film is author Toby Rohn. Toby, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, always.
It's always great to have you. Why don't you take a moment here, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, my name is Toby Rohn. I run a couple of movie blogs, 50 Westerns from the 50s and The Hannibal 8. And I've written a book about One-Eyed Jacks with Marlon Brando, and I just wrote a book about the movie we're talking about today, The Gauntlet. It's one I liked when I saw it back in 77 and just always occupied a lot of space inside my head. And so it turns out people either love it or hate it, and I liked it enough to write a little book about it. So I guess that's pretty much it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we will dig more into that for sure. Toby's been on the show a lot. We've talked about lots of different films. I mean, he mentioned his project 50 Westerns from the 50s. That's where I first got to know him from, and we've had him on to talk about Westerns from time to time, but we've also talked about some other films. You know, we've talked about teen crime films and gangster films and a bunch of different stuff with Toby. I've always thought of you, mainly with films from like the 50s and the 60s. But here we are today in the 70s.
I
so
know.
I want to get your just general thoughts on this particular decade. Because, you know, I mean, I know if you're like me, we like films from all different eras of film. But, you know, as I get to know people, I kind of know what their wheelhouse is. And you I've always thought of as like the 50s and 60s. But tell us about, maybe what resonates for you about the 70s.
Well, we've kind of probably talked about this before, but I grew up in a house full of old movies. So, and I grew up in the 70s. So movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, I just wallowed in those things as a kid. I got to see them on film, which was such a blessing. But at the same time, I was just like everybody, every other kid in the 70s. I grew up going to the movies. And so 70s movies have a real big fat place in my heart, from things like, you know, everything from the spaghetti westerns like They Call Me Trinity to Jaws, things like that, of course, and Star Wars, you know, all that stuff. So while I was wallowing in all those things, like, you know, the Whistler movies and Audie Murphy westerns and old Roy Rogers pictures and stuff, I was also going to the same things everybody else did. And so as I look at it, looking back on it, I guess, I think the 70s, in my opinion, was the last great decade for movies. They just knocked me out. I love them. Action movies are cool. You know, sort of the cynical stuff and so many things like French Connection and Sorcerer and so other movies. I love all that stuff, too. So, and of course, all the horror stuff, the Hammer movies were winding down at that time, and things like At the Earth's Core, which is another one of my favorites, all that kind of stuff. So that's pretty much it. Just going to movies like everybody else.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about the 50s stuff. And I mean, it's interesting. There's really a stark contrast between, you know, the type of stuff we're seeing in the 50s and the type of stuff we're seeing as we move into the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, the 50s stuff, I mean, it's a lot of fun. And certainly there's some, you know, similar elements at play. But I mean, you can't really, I guess, you know, realism and grit are not the terms that come to mind first when I think about 50s cinema.
No.
Whereas when we move into the 70s, they're trying much more to have that kind of that edge to things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that I don't know. It seems like a little bit of a you know, some warring factions there when it comes to,
well,
you know, having taste in 50s films, but then as we move into the 70s.
Right. Well, a lot of my favorite 50s films, like the Westerns, you know, they were getting darker and more realistic, and, you know, you didn't have the white hat kind of hero, all that kind of stuff. So you were bringing in a little bit of that realism, a little bit of that grit was coming in then. And then even in the 40s, you had a lot of that on location stuff for crime movies, you know, film noir and all that kind of stuff. So you're getting a lot of that grit was coming in there. And then the B movies from the 30s on up, you know, the really cheap ones, they often had that kind of stuff. And the 60s are weird because you had some of that grit and that realism and that sort of documentary type approach to things. But you also had those like really big, shiny pieces of eye candy, like one of our favorites, The Great Race.
Right.
So the 60s is like really kind of crazy because it sort of exists sort of in between the 50s and the 70s in a way.
There's a bit of a playfulness to a lot of cinema of the 60s. I mean, The Great Race is a great example of that, but also, like, you know, when I start thinking of the 60s, some of the first films that come to mind for me are like the Beach Party films and things like that.
Right. And that's one of my all-time favorite films is Bikini Beach. I mean, that's like, that's just one of the most perfect stylized things ever. You know, just the whole way they presented what the whole California beach life was like is just totally fake. And it's great. And growing up in Georgia, I thought it was real. But but yeah, that's what's kind of interesting about movies is how they sort of, that sort of evolution. And then something about the 70s, I guess when Technicolor started to die and everything started going to Eastman color and stuff, you didn't have that sort of Hollywood look so much anymore. So movies looked, your big movies looked more like the news.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, so even aesthetically, you sort of had that sort of transition as well. I mean, you look at something like French Connection, it looks exactly like the news. I just love it. And then there's just that sort of comedy in the 70s got this really kind of goofy thing, you know, everything from the Robert Altman movies to, you know, one of my all-time favorite movies, Slither, with James Caan.
Slither's great. We've talked about it on this show before.
Oh, that's a great one. And Freebie and the Bean, another favorite. I mean, just sort of comedy just kind of went into this weird sort of natural kind of thing as well. So it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in
decade. Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this film, I mean, I'm sure we'll get into it more as we talk about it, but as I was watching it, I was going, oh, well, I could see the echoes of this in so many 80s movies that I
absolutely
love.
Absolutely.
That's
the key thing about it.
Before we kind of give the basic overview, what this is about, and I don't want you to get too much into, you know, the nuts and bolts of the movie itself here, because we're going to go in depth. But you've written a whole thing on this movie, The Gauntlet. So, you know, what is it that made this, you know, stick with you and you know, drew you to want to, you know, write a bit more about this film?
Well, when I saw it, I was 13 years old when I saw it. And it made a big impression. It was big and loud and all kinds of stuff blows up and gets torn up. And it had a great score. I loved the music from the minute I saw it. But the main thing was that poster, that Frank Frazetta poster.
Oh,
I remember going to see something else at this theater where I eventually saw The Gauntlet, and it was hanging up in there. And I was just like, that has to be the greatest movie ever. It just has to be based on that poster. It's incredible. But, I think what made it stick with me is that I just am a big fan of the underdog, no matter what it is. And people just ragged on this movie from the beginning. You know, Eastwood had made this great leap forward as a director with Outlaw Josie Wales, and then he followed it up with this. And I think people were like, what is this crap? I think there was that kind of a, you know, he's like, he went lowbrow on them and they didn't like it. But what also is really, is interesting about it is though people ragged on it for being ridiculous, it serves as kind of a prototype or at least a hint at what action movies were going to turn into further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the over the top stuff and one, you know, sort of unbelievable set piece after another. It's very, very much points to what we'd go see hundreds of later, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this was a first time watch for me, so I'm anxious to get into this. Let's get on with it here. The Gauntlet from 1977. Now, it's interesting. I initially was like, okay, can I count this as a forgotten film? Because, I mean, it's Clint Eastwood. How forgotten can a Clint Eastwood film be, you know, ultimately?
Right, exactly.
And I started doing some digging, you know, when you were kind of talking about this film. You've mentioned this film on the show before, and, you know, you've mentioned to me that the book was coming out. And so I was looking at, and I was really surprised because I was looking on, like, Letterboxd. And when you pull up like an actor or a director on Letterboxd and it sorts their films for you, it, you know, puts it in the order of popularity based on like how many people have clicked that they watched it or reviewed it and all those different factors together. The algorithms decide, you know, what's the most popular for a certain person. And I was really surprised. The Gauntlet is way down the list on Clint Eastwood. I mean, it's underneath like Tarantula and stuff. Okay. So I was like, okay, yeah, this will fit for the show. So anyway, this is, of course, not only starring Clint Eastwood, but directed by Clint Eastwood. As you said, it's his fifth film as a director. His first, of course, was Play Misty for Me in 1971, followed by High Plains Drifter, Breezy, The Iger Sanction, and Outlaw Josie Wales. So, I mean, he's had a pretty good run here, you know, leading up to this. Now, in this film, he plays a guy named Ben Shockley. He's kind of a down-and-out Phoenix cop. And as the film opens, he's summoned by the police commissioner, Edgar Blakelock, played by William Prince, for a special assignment. Basically, he is being sent to Las Vegas to pick up a witness for a trial, a witness by the name of Gus Malley. Now, he's told that this is a nothing witness for a nothing trial, okay? So Shockley flies up to Vegas and goes to the prison where he's shocked to learn that the witness is actually one Augustina Malley. Get it? Gus, okay? Gus for short. She's a prostitute played by, of course, Sandra Locke. And she insists that there's going to be trouble. There's going to be an attempt to kill her if he tries to take her back to Phoenix, which means that Shockley then is going to be a target himself as well. Now, he doubts this at first, but when the car that they are supposed to drive to the airport blows up before they can even get into it, he starts to have a different frame of mind. And from there, it is basically a dangerous journey across the desert as Shockley and Malley attempt to get back to Phoenix without being killed. There's a lot of craziness that happens along the way. At one point, they kidnap a cop and you know, have him drive them a certain distance. They steal a motorcycle from some bikers at one point. They get chased on said bike by a helicopter, and they jump a train at one point. And then eventually, they hijack a bus, which they crudely turn into a bit of an armored fortress, kind of A-Team style there, so they can drive back into the streets of Phoenix as the police fire on them from all angles, basically the gauntlet that the title speaks of. Now, as we said, this was released in 1977. Back in 77, it was relatively successful. According to Box Office Mojo, it's coming in at about 18th at the box office for the year. But remember, this is 1977, a year when the box office was pretty much dominated by one little film called Star Wars. And then even the films that come right after it in like the top five, you've got stuff like Smokey and the Bandit, Saturday Night Fever, Close Encounters, you know, so some pretty big films standing in the way of this. So, you know, 18th is okay, but in a year where you've got Star Wars, yeah, it's a big gap. So, right. So anyway, I'm going to let Toby get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on The Gauntlet.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I'll go give you a little bit of background. Just how it ended up getting made is pretty interesting. The script was offered to Marlon Brando and Barbara Streisand, and Brando said no. And then it went to Steve McQueen, and he said no. And then it went to Clint Eastwood, and it was going to be Barbara Streisand and Clint Eastwood. And Eastwood kind of passive-aggressively made it work where it didn't have Barbara Streisand in it, I guess you'd say. And so it became an Eastwood movie, and he, he directed it. And, you know, it was only the second movie he made with Sandra Locke after Hollow Josie Wales. So their romance, or whatever you want to call it, kind of really got going while making this. But so it's interesting when you watch it to kind of think about, imagine this with some of those other people in it. And then, you know, the idea was that they would try to figure out how to put some songs in it with Streisand and things like that. It just sounds kind of crazy. But it's just this movie that I just find it interesting that it just, you know, you got these people, they're both kind of losers, and they kind of go about this thing. And Eastwood's playing very much against type at this point, because he's not the invincible gunfighter or, you know, San Francisco police detective. He's just this kind of drunk Phoenix cop. And you pull for him, and then they just kind of go from one crazy thing to the next. And then they sort of hate each other at first, and then they start to kind of begrudgingly tolerate each other. And then eventually they, you know, they get together. And it doesn't feel totally nailed onto the movie. It works pretty well. And Eastwood actually has a dialogue scene that's probably the longest one he had in any movie up to this point. Eastwood made a lot of movies in this period, you know, that people either love or hate. And he was just doing all kinds of different things, you know, from Pink Cadillac to Heartbreak Ridge to, you know, Any Which Way But Loose, or and all that kind of stuff. And so this was kind of one of the first of those where he kind of deviated from his normal thing. And I kind of appreciate it for that, if nothing else. But I just really like it. It's big and loud and dumb. And I've always liked movies that are big and loud and dumb. up to the 70s. Big and loud and dumb movies now I don't care much for. But I guess even I have a point at which I have to. There's too big, too loud, and too dumb. But it's got the 70s kind of movie vibe, you know. It just kind of ambles along. In some ways, it feels kind of plotless. It's very episodic because it's just one action sequence after another with a little bit here and there to nail them together. Character actors in it are great. Pat Hingle's great. William Prince is really creepy. You know, Eastwood's is cool. It's probably the best part Sandra Locke ever had in one of her Eastwood movies.
I think I would agree with that.
It's a good part. I mean, she's cool in it.
I mean, I really like her in Bronco Billy as well.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But yeah, no, I thought this was a great part for her. I want to dig into that more for sure. But yeah, I mean, like I said, this was a first time watch for me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think everything you're saying there about it, but kind of being big and dumb is correct. And I'm a sucker for that type of thing as well. It's also, as I was watching it, I was like, well, this is a great example of that kind of approach that Eastwood has become known for. You know, he's got this kind of lean economical approach to things. You know, he's known for not wasting takes and, you know, getting down to business. And, you know, this is a film where he doesn't waste time with anything on this. I mean, the movie just it starts and we're off and going. I mean, you know, the credits roll as we see, you know, we're introduced to Shockley, just seeing him stumble out of a bar and make his way to the police station because he's got an assignment. He's all disheveled. He's unshaven, which Pat Hingle mentions a lot. You know, you need to shave. He's a wreck. And, you know, just in that, we learn everything we need to know about this guy. And he goes and he gets the assignment, and then we're off and going. And we never really dwell too much on anything. We're just given enough to move things forward and kind of just give the most minimal explanation of why this is happening. I mean, we know that Sandra Locke is, you know, a witness, and she's got some kind of information that's damaging to somebody. The mob is interested, all this kind of stuff. But we never really dwell too much on what exactly it is. We get a bit, but it's not like we just dwell on this and on why this is so significant, blah, blah, blah. No, she's important. Someone wants her dead, and that's enough.
Right. And that's one of the things that a really good action movie does, which is tells you no more than you need to know. And that pretty much just provides a backbone to nail all these action scenes on. Mm-hmm. And if you keep it moving fast enough, which this one does, you don't stop too much and think about how ridiculous it might be.
Yeah, and it gets pretty ridiculous.
It does. And it kind of blows it toward the end, that with obvious stuff with the tires and stuff. But it's still, by that point, you're invested enough. I don't think it hurts it too much. But that's what I like. One of the things I really like about it is just goes along, and the next thing you know, it's over. It really moves. So it's very well edited. And you're right, the direction is very, very economical. And, you know, I wonder if some of the scenes, if there was a lot more explanation stuff that was cut out along the way, or if that was a decision that was made. I know Eastwood said that his revisions to the script were mostly removing things. So maybe that was in his head all along. So.
Well, and I think Eastwood knows where the right moments are, where he can kind of dwell a little bit. Like, there are some great scenes that are dialogue scenes, and, you know, they never get to where they kind of wear out their welcome.
Right.
You know, the two scenes that jump out for me on that are, there's the one where it's coming as we're gearing up for the third act with Eastwood and Locke in the hotel room.
Yes.
And, you know, it's where, you know, we're starting to get more the hints that there's maybe a little spark going on here now, right, and all that. And, you know, we do get some detail in that scene, and it's really well. I think it's actually a really great example. I mean, you know, you talked about this being one of Locke's better performances in an Eastwood film. I think that's a scene that really shows that this wasn't just a guy hiring his girlfriend. These two had chemistry.
Yes, absolutely.
And then the other scene that jumped out at me that's dialogue heavy, that again is really effective, is the whole bit with the constable where they kidnap him. And, you know, there's this whole kind of exchange where, as a viewer, you're wondering, okay, is this guy getting on board with them? Is he sympathizing with them a little bit? Or, you know, is he just like, well, I'm just looking for my opportunity here because I'm going to nail you.
Right.
You know, I like that. I kept questioning what was going on there. And then the scene turns really dark when he starts, you know, just egging on Sandra Locke,
right,
you know, about the fact that she's a prostitute and all that, and really becomes somewhat disturbing. And I was like, that's a scene that really, you know, for a movie that's all about these kind of centerpiece moments of action and violence and explosions and such, here's a great dialogue sequence that really just stands out.
Right. And it is very dark. And the scene with the bikers in the boxcar on the train is very dark for a movie like this. And it's actually kind of a little difficult to watch in some ways. But it's funny. It doesn't completely just go for total escapism popcorn movie stuff. It still has some nice scenes in it. And, you know, you kind of expect, you know, movie language says that, you know, a man and a woman in a situation like this are going to fall for each other before it's over. And this movie really doesn't just do that. It really, you watch that relationship develop. Mm-hmm. And as the many times I've seen it, especially as I was working on the book, I just really started to watch that and go, boy, this is really well put together. And it's well written. It's extremely well acted. And it just really works. And so there's a lot more going on to it than, it, you know, superficially, it's just this thing. But when you really kind of study it, there's a lot more there. And I know that there's probably people who go, really? This is the movie with Clint Eastwood in the bus? Are you serious? So.
Well, I mean, going back to, you know, Sandra Locke and Clint Eastwood and their dynamic on screen. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, various other people were, you know, the original choices for this movie before Eastwood got involved. And I mean, I think, you know, looking at the fact that Barbara Streisand was one of the choices, I mean, let's face it, Barbara Streisand is a star on a level that is quite different than where Sandra Locke would have been. You know, was this a point of contention? Was, you know, like we said, is this looked at as, oh, he's hiring his girlfriend? I mean, like I said, I think it works quite well. The two work very well together, not just in this film. I think if you look at other films, you can see they had on-screen chemistry. Bronco Billy, again, I think a great example of that. But I mean, you know, as you were looking at the background on the movie, was that something that was, you know, maybe a fly in the ointment, because we go from we're going to cast this, one of the biggest named stars in the world in Barbara Streisand, and we go to the director star's girlfriend.
Right. Well, it's kind of weird because the way when I was looking into it, and a lot of this came from Sandra Locke's book, which is not a real joyous read, by the way. But she said that Eastwood just sort of said, yeah, okay, all right, and let the studio kind of make things happen, but he never would really commit. And then the next thing you knew, it was too late to get Streisand in it. And he said, oh, okay, well, I'm going to put her in it. Mm-hmm. And he had always kind of, he had told Sandra Locke that he had this next thing he was going to do, had a great part for her. And of course he was right. But, it kind of makes you wonder if he ever really intended to do it with Barbara Streisand.
Oh, I don't doubt that a bit. I mean, as you were describing that, I was thinking that sounds just like the way I would expect Clint Eastwood to go about doing something.
Right, exactly. And he definitely has kind of a passive aggressive way, evidently, of dealing with business matters. But I can't imagine this movie with Barbara Streisand in it. And that's not because I'm not a Barbara Streisand fan. I'm not, but she's pretty good in some things. What's Up Doc, for instance, is wonderful, but it just didn't need any extra star power in it. That would have really distracted from sort of the gritty little sort of subversive little movie that it really kind of wants to be. And I think that's another thing that I really like about it, is you just really get this feeling that Eastwood was really wanting to do something different. You know, he had kind of gotten a place. He was a big deal now. He could direct his own stuff and choose his own projects and all those kinds of things. And so, and for the next however many movies he made, half a dozen or so, he just went all over the place. And so he was really kind of playing with things. And I think that this is a great one to start that off with. It's definitely a Clint Eastwood movie, but it's, not exactly like Clint Eastwood movies anybody had ever seen before.
It is. And jumping off what you're saying there, it is very different than what we expect for him. I mean, especially going back to Sandra Locke's role in things here. I mean, with these two characters, the more abrasive one is Sandra Locke.
Right, right. He never shoots anybody. She shoots somebody. He does not. She has more dialogue. She's the stronger character. She's the more interesting character. Eastwood served the story very well. He didn't, change things around to make him out to be the hero, because in a lot of ways he's not.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, in many ways he's along for the ride.
Right.
And he's kind of fumbling his way through this. In fact, one of my impressions with this was that, in some stuff I read, I'm sure you know more about this than I do. I read that at one point they considered this possibly being another Dirty Harry movie,
right,
that it was going to be Harry Callahan.
Yeah.
And I thought, Shockley and Callahan are very different. I never really get the impression that Shockley is a particularly good cop.
No. He's, like he says, he was just going to do his 20 and retire. And so he's just a plain old 9-to-5 kind of guy. And I think that's actually one of the movie's strengths, I think, is that we're just expecting him to pull out a great big gun and start blowing people away, and he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's what one of the things that does is, by having Sandra Locke be such a strong character, and the dialogue scene with the constable that you talked about is a great example. Eastwood gets to react a lot.
Yeah.
And he is so good. He reminds me of John Wayne, and John Wayne was such a great reactor. And Eastwood's kind of doing that a lot. Just the way he kind of cocks his eyebrow and looks at her is, throughout the movie, is great.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it kind of bothers me about not the film itself, but just the way films are, but the way people are about this movie is, a long time ago, almost 10 years ago, I wrote a big blog post on the Hannibal 8 about this. And they got a couple of comments, nothing unusual. But people emailed me, not publicly in the comments. They emailed me and told me how much they loved this movie.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. Why don't you just comment? but nobody did. And so as time went on, it also, when you look at the little analytics and stuff that WordPress offers up, it's one of the most across the board popular blog posts I ever did. It continues to be one of the leading ones year after year after year. And so that was one of the things that kind of struck me. And that's one of the reasons that kind of led to the book is, why don't people admit they like this movie? What's going on with this movie? And then people start calling it a guilty pleasure. And I can't stand the idea of a guilty pleasure. You either like something or you don't. And so to go, it's a piece of crap, but I like it. No, it just is what it is. And you like it or you don't, And so I just thought it was interesting that people that decided to hide in the shadows and confess their love of the Gauntlet.
Well, it's interesting that, people would, maybe be a little ashamed of that or put it in that category of guilty pleasure. I could see where they might do that. But at the same time, all throughout watching this movie, there were these things about it that I went, oh, well, I've seen that again in this 80s movie or, in this.
Right.
There's so many things that it seemed like might have pulled some degree of inspiration from this. Other, those movies we look at, we don't consider them guilty pleasures, but we see them taking some of the same kind of crazy stuff that's in this. There were a number of movies that popped into my mind as I was watching this. One of the elements I really sat on quite a bit was just the kind of road movie aspect of
right,
this.
Right, exactly.
Which I love road movies.
Me too.
I feel like I've mentioned that on a bunch of recent episodes of this show because we've talked about several movies that could be considered road movies. But, there were elements of this where I was, making mental comparisons to everything from Midnight Run
exactly.
to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles,
yep.
and it was kind of delightful to see all that, there's a lot of things here that as we're in the late 70s, I think you can see come to fruition as we look at mm-hmm. some very popular films from the 1980s.
Yep, exactly. And road movies are great. They're great. And the 70s was this like the decade for road movies. I mean, and Midnight Run should have been made in the 70s. It has that kind of feel to it. I guess thanks to Charles Grodin more than anything else. But that's a huge appeal of it to me. And road movies always seem to be kind of more or less plotless. You just sort of bounce from one thing to the next as you mm-hmm. try to get to from point A to point B. And so that's a huge, huge piece of this movie, that sort of ambling kind of plotless plot that it does so well. And you just, you don't think about it too much. It just sort of goes. And one of the things I was thinking about the other day is the Gauntlet pretty much uses every type of transportation that we know of. Car, bus, helicopter,
motorcycle. Yeah,
I mean, everything. I mean, I was like, okay, there's no bulldozer, but that's about it, So that's very cool.
Well, talking about how the movie kind of, ambles along and jumps, from one moment to another, I want to give you a chance, just to throw out what are some of the highlight moments for you here, because we have, certain scenes, where, we've got action in various ways, we've got chases, we've got cops shooting up a house, we've got all kinds of things. So what are the moments that jump out for you?
Well, I like the scene in the house. The house is interesting. And what's great about the house is it comes early enough in the movie that it just sort of it just pulls the rug out from under you. Normal movie logic is gone. This house has been shot so much that it collapses. And so from then on, it's like all bets are off. They can do anything. And they've sort of – and I think that it's – I mean, this is kind of a stretch, but – think about Psycho. Once you kill Janet Lee 45 minutes into the movie, you're like, what do you do? You can't trust Hitchcock anymore because he just totally pulled the rug out from you. And this movie does that to a lighter degree in that, you've never seen anything like this. What in the world are they going to do next? And so that sort of puts your head in a certain gear, and I think that helps it go through, you know, kind of propels it through the rest of the movie, of that anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that sequence. And I just, you know, a lot of people complain about it for all kinds of reasons, but I really like the scene with the bus at the end. I know they should have, you know, the tires don't pop. And I know that if you had cops on either side of the street shooting, they'd be shooting each other.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. I get all of that. I totally get it. I totally understand. And then a lot of people say it just goes on too long. But if it was only 3 minutes long, a movie that's called The Gauntlet, you got the burning bus on the poster.
Right.
You know, people are going to complain that there wasn't enough bus if they didn't. So I just like the scene on the bus. It's cool. It's loud. And the movie is you know it's going to have a big finish. It has to. I mean, a house falls down from bullets, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes into it. You're going to have to go out with a bang. And so what's better than, you know, 10,000 bullets and a bus?
The entire Phoenix police force
exactly,
firing at this thing, which I enjoyed the sequence. There's actually a part of me that wanted it to go a little further, even.
Me too.
I was
me
like,
too.
There was a part of me. Well, I like, you know, the way that Eastwood's character is kind of manipulating the situation and all that. That's fun. That's clever. I was disappointed when they said that they're closing the streets, and I was like, no, we need just chaos everywhere. You know,
might be like the opening scene in The Wild Bunch that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Also cool, and I think this is important, is that Eastwood gets shot in the leg, and he drives them, and then eventually his leg bothers him so much that he hands over the wheel to Sandra Locke.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the big finish, and he hands it over to her, and you know at the end he just mashes the gas pedal down with his hand. But you know, it's interesting, you know. People always talk about women's roles in Eastwood movies are terrible, but, you know, she gets to take the movie over the finish line. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very cool. Well, and, you know, the tire thing. We've got to talk about the tire thing. In the script, the tires pop, and they drive on the rims the rest of the way. And there were sparks and, you know, the squeal and grinding noises of, you know, the rims on the asphalt. Well, the city of Phoenix, you know, they cooperated quite a bit, but they did not want Eastwood to tear up their streets with a bus with no tires.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became it. Now, I, you know, you could have shot around it. You could have done it with inserts and sound design. It could have been covered, but they didn't.
Yeah.
They just, and then they let the tires pop once the bus stops. But, you know, oh, well.
It's a fun sequence. I mean, like so much of this film, it is completely ridiculous. And, you know, you definitely need to, you know, suspend reality, so to speak. But, I mean, that's what going to the movies is all about.
Yep,
so, you know,
exactly.
The sequence that I really loved in this film was the motorcycle / helicopter chase.
Oh, yeah.
It's, first of all, a fun moment leading up to that, where you have Eastwood confront the bikers who have randomly shown up at this, you know, out by this cave where they've been hiding out. And there's this whole interchange that they have with them. And I was thinking, oh, you know, here's Eastwood and his bikers, you know, he's
right.
Put bikers in other movies, you know? And so they, you know, they end up stealing one of the bikes, and then a helicopter shows up and it's going to start shooting at them and all that. And they're zooming around on this motorcycle on these little dirt trails going around this rock formation. And there's these, you know, little narrow tunnels going through it, which I live in Colorado, and I've hiked trails like that before. I mean, like, usually when I see that, I go, oh, that's an old railroad line.
Right.
That's where the mine cars were going. You know, like I hiked a trail like that a few years ago when my wife and I went up to Canyon City. You know, it's great. And,
right.
You know, so they're zooming this motorcycle around these rock formations through these little tunnels and stuff. And the helicopter is going around there and shooting at them and all this stuff. and there's power lines. And I was like, oh, I can see it coming a mile away, but I am overjoyed, you know, and it's so appropriate that we're talking about this movie here today. I'm recording multiple podcasts this morning, and just a few hours before we're doing this, I was recording a guest spot on Will Slater's Exploding Helicopter podcast. And so I got to talk about two movies with an exploding helicopter today because The Gauntlet has one. It gets tangled up in the power lines and it's wonderful.
It is wonderful. And those tunnels are very cool. Those are outside Las Vegas somewhere. Those were built for the construction of the Hoover Dam.
Oh, okay.
And so parts of them are still there. They're part of a park, I believe. And you can hike them and all that other kind of stuff. So that's always been on my list. It's someplace I want to go. I was only going to walk in go check out the Gauntlet tunnels.
But, well, we haven't dwelt too much on some of the supporting players yet. I want to give you a chance on those before we start moving to the break. I mean, you mentioned briefly, you know, like Pat Hingle, in here, which, you know, I think he's got a fun little role. And then of course our chief villain, of the whole thing, William Prince.
William Prince, boy, he's a scumbag in this.
Oh man. He is just slimy from the start. And again, it's one of those cases where I don't think there's a whole lot of mystery. I think from that opening moment where he gives Eastwood the assignment, you pretty much know he's the bad guy, I think.
Yeah, you
know,
you do.
I don't think they really do much to hide that. You're going, this is suspicious. And like I said earlier, you know, I kind of throughout this never really had the impression that Shockley is a particularly good cop. And, you know, part of this moment, I kind of get the impression like, you know, he's kind of saying, well, you know, let's kill two birds with one stone. We're going to get rid of this dangerous witness. And, you know, Shockley's an embarrassment to the force. Let's get rid of him too.
Right. He was chosen because they were certain he would fail.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is interesting about William Prince's part is, aside from him just seeming like a creep, all of the stuff about how vile and evil he is just from Sandra Locke talking about him.
Uh-huh.
We don't see any of it. We just hear some short little dialogue here and there about what a scumbag he is. But that's enough, and it really works. I mean, his performance takes that ball and runs with it very, very far.
Yeah.
Of course, Pat Hingle's always great. I love Pat Hingle. And the guy who plays the constable,
Bill McKinney.
Yeah. Bill McKinney, he's terrific. I mean, he's always terrific, but he was really good here because he got to be funny and he got to be a creep because he's always ends up being a creep. But he just got, it was just a really good part. And like you said, to walk that line that they do between kind of funny and then really dark and weird, you know, he really plays that really well because he just think he's just some kind of hit cop. And then he turns out to be such a freak that it, you know, that could have really fallen flat if it wasn't for him being so good.
Also, like Michael Cavanaugh, the assistant district attorney, you know, it's not a big part, but he just looks like such a bundle of nerves the whole thing. He's
exactly.
Just, you know, he looks all tense and sweaty the whole time, like he knows he's on the wrong team, you know.
Right. He's also does a very good job of being that sort of like mid-level corrupt politician kind of guy, you know, government slime ball.
Yeah.
He really does that well.
Yeah. I mean, for a movie where, I mean, for the most part, it's focusing on our two leads, you know, throughout. They're the central focus of just about every scene. The supporting players do get some good moments.
Right. Exactly. They do. And I think a lot of it is, you know, they don't have a lot of screen time, but they're all so good that they really make the most of the scenes they have. I mean, Bill McKinney has pretty much one scene, really. You know, you introduce him and then you kill him. And then there's that he drives. For about what, 5, 7, 8, however many minutes of the movie, he just drives them, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so, but he really makes an impression. I mean, he's one of the things that most people remember about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well,
I want to bring up the music real quick.
Oh, that's actually, I was going to say the same thing.
Jerry Fielding did the music, and he had Art Pepper was one of the players on it. So it's Eastwood's a big jazz fan, and they for this movie they decided to take that a little bit further than normal. I mean, his score for The Enforcer has a pretty good jazz feel to it, but they really took it you know, a big leap forward with this one, and I loved it. It made a huge impression on me when I saw it, and kind of I'm not a huge jazz fan, but this was the movie that sort of made me start listening to that stuff. Just like Bonnie and Clyde and the Andy Griffith Show hipped me to bluegrass, which I love. This one did it with jazz. It just really, really knocked me out. I wish that it had been mixed a bit louder, because it has to compete with a lot of noise, but it's a great score.
It is a great score, and it, you know, right from the beginning, we get it. It sets the mood very well through the opening credits.
Sure does.
And again, it was one of those things that, as I watched this movie, I was like, well, this is just another Eastwood Hallmark type of thing, because I know he's a jazz guy, and you know, he does often have that kind of feel to some of his films. And yeah, I thought this was a great score. Absolutely. Yep.
I played the crap out of the record when it came out.
All right. Well, before we go to the break, I'll give you a chance for any final thoughts or last little bits of trivia or whatever you want to offer up on this one. I mean, of course, we want people to dig into the book. But any last few things you want to share on The Gauntlet?
It's 109 minutes. It feels like it's 39 minutes. I mean, it just really moves. It's one of those movies that a lot of people who didn't care much for it when they first saw it have revisited it, you know, intentionally or not, and have really had second thoughts about it, really come around to appreciate it more and more. So if you don't remember liking it very much, give it a shot, because there's a lot more there than you remember.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it. I mean, like you say, it's big, it's dumb. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely.
Big and dumb is fun sometimes. And I thought this was a fun ride. Absolutely.
Well, it's the thing that's cool is there's a lot of smarts behind the big and dumb. I think there that's is. What makes a there. Lot of the difference is that the craft and the act, the performances really take it over the edge.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no, go
cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it.
That's just how it works.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few measly little old dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the old episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us. And we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. Fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed that we want to make sure everybody else checks out. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. It might be something new in theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Toby, what is your recommendation?
I watched this just a few weeks ago. It's one I loved as a kid. The Creeping Flesh from 1973 with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, directed by Freddie Francis. It is just another one of those British mid-70s horror movies, and I love it. Peter Cushing is my favorite actor that didn't make Western. So I will watch him in anything. And this one is just a lot of fun. A lot of the 70s ones, you know, the British horror film industry was kind of winding down. But this one was a lot of fun. And what I like about it is that it's the story of this skeleton that Peter Cushing brings back from Papua New Guinea. And once it gets wet, the flesh starts growing back on it. And so the whole movie, we're waiting for something to happen to get that stupid skeleton wet so it can go on the rampage, because we know it will. But there is so much other stuff in this movie with Cushing's wife has been in the mental institution, and the mental institution is run by his brother, Christopher Lee, who's looks at the skeleton as a way for him to make a name for himself. All this crazy stuff. And then there's Cushing's daughter, who kind of goes nuts. It's just one of those, you know, some movies are so overly plotted that they're horrible. This one is overly plotted in a really fun way. And so you kind of get on and go, where in the world are they going next? And then, of course, the whole time just waiting for that skeleton to get wet. So I just really love it. Nobody's better at that ridiculous fake scientific dialogue than Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And they just it's just great. It's great.
Oh, I mean, well, anytime they're together, it's a reason to watch a movie. This is one I haven't seen, though. So, yeah, I need to check this one out.
It's a good one. Horror Express is from 71 or 72 is also great. But, you know, this isn't a Hammer film. This was Tigon. And it was directed by Freddie Francis, a cinematographer who directed quite a few British horror pictures. But it's wonderful.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, for my recommendation, I, you know, you can say I might be lazy today. That's okay, because I'm just going to go with a movie that I love so much that we talked briefly about in our discussion of The Gauntlet. So my recommendation is going to be the previously mentioned Midnight Run.
From
1988, one of my favorite 80s movies. You know, I think if you're familiar with Midnight Run, when you watch The Gauntlet, you're going to see a bunch of stuff there that you're going, oh, well, Martin Brest clearly took some inspiration here, especially that motorcycle chase that I was talking about. We don't have a motorcycle chase in Midnight Run, but, you know, we have a similar style car helicopter chase in that also ends with an exploding helicopter. I mean, Midnight Run, it's a movie that's got a lot of the type of things we talked about with The Gauntlet, where we've got, you know, some stuff that's big and crazy, you know, with all sorts of different forces chasing after our two central characters. But then also, I mean, the thing that makes that movie work so well is the great dynamic between Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin, a very much an adversarial type of a relationship. Not unlike what we've got going on with Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke. And I mean, you know, in The Gauntlet, it ends in a romance. Here, you know, it ends in a bit of a unique friendship and understanding by the time we get to the end of the film. There's just so many great things at play in this movie. Great action scenes, great dialogue, a number of wonderful supporting players as well, from John Ashton to Dennis Farina to Joey Pants. So many great people in that movie. Midnight Run is a movie I could literally turn on and watch anytime and never get bored of it. So
yeah, I think I could too. And both of those movies, it's interesting, while they're known, they both have just great dialogue and great people delivering that dialogue. And it just, so, you know, you don't come away from an action type movie with quoting it, but you know, those you do, there's just a lot of really great scenes. And I think that's important, is that the ones that stand the test of time are the ones that don't just blow crap up. They've got something else there, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's just some nice little action scenes with people talking, or, you know, all the great interplay between, you know, De Niro and Charles Grodin in Midnight Run. But these would make an interesting double feature, too.
They would, absolutely. Well, Toby, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Before
I let you go here, please remind everybody where they can find your stuff, and especially the new book that's available.
Okay, well, the Westerns blog is 50 Westerns from the 50s. The URL is just 50swesterns.com. 50s is spelled out. The other blog is The Hannibal 8. It's any movie I like that's not a Western. The book is called Another Run Through the Gauntlet, and it's self-published on Amazon. And it's a quick read. It's a short little book. It's really just a Valentine to a movie that I really like.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your love of this movie. And we will be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Film Cast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Film Cast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. We welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.